All right. Good afternoon, everybody.
Hi.
Exciting day?
Yes.
You've been to a few sessions earlier?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a beautiful day. So welcome. My name is Mahesh Das, and I have the rare privilege of serving as the president of the Boston Architectural College, who is also hosting this wonderful event. And the additional privilege of actually presenting the book as well. So I thought, let's just mark that special moment of coming together of all of these, alignment, right? Not every day, not every year. So I am so excited to welcome you to our home here. So you are sitting in a building that was actually originally a police station. Then it was Institute for Contemporary Arts building. Then it became Boston Architectural College building since 2007. And it has a very special relief right there. It's Beehive. That is why it is named Beehive. And it was by one of the earlier deans, legendary deans of the BAC, Arcangelo Cashieri. So that's how the name of this place has been derived. And back there, you see there is a little opening with terracotta and brick opening. So when we were actually refurbishing, renovating this building, we discovered that. So we left it open so you can actually slide the doors and see what that original work was like. So we are so excited, along with my co-author, whom we will introduce, so we can get started with our presentation today. We are going to be self-moderating. So we'll moderate ourselves and have a good conversation. First, we will have some passages that we would like to read from the book to introduce you to the ideas and the themes and the emotions. And then we will have a robust conversation about it. So it's going to be about a 15-minute presentation, followed by plenty of time for Q&A and a discussion. So with that said, once again, for those who are just arriving, my name is Mahesh Das, and co-author of this book, iKnowBot, which this is the launch of the book today. It is the first time it is being launched. And we have just a few advanced copies that we got as author copies, so we thought maybe we should just bring them to the festival. So we brought them to the festival. But in the market, it is going to be available in November. But it's available for pre-ordering. So with that, I'd like to welcome my co-author, Andrew John Witt.
Well, thank you all for coming here today. thank you all for coming here today. It's been a pleasure working with Mahesh on this project, so we look forward to sharing it with you all today. So,
I'll tell you what the secret is that Andrew and I go back 20 plus years, 23, 24 years, probably something like that. And Andrew was one of my students at University of Texas at San Antonio. And then he came to Boston to study at MIT, and he worked in Japan and elsewhere. And so we continue to be collaborators. So a special privilege, and I'm so grateful and thankful to have a collaborator like Andrew to work on our second book together. So,
thanks, Mahesh.
Yeah, we'll get rolling with the presentation of the day. Once upon a time.
Once upon a time, in this case, a few billion years. We always wanted to begin our book with once upon a time, so there you are.
Did we say we are two robots? Does it come as a shock? Granted, we are not the first to realize who we are. The credit goes to a humanist robot named Rodney Brooks, who revealed himself a robot in the year 2008 AD. We still have some doubts about our self-realizations, but then we think skepticism is healthier than certainty.
This is not the first time that robots have written books. But we argue this is indeed the first time two self-realized robots have penned a book. Our previous book, Towards a Robotic Architecture, gave us an elaborate excuse to delve into the mysteries of robots and humans.
Humans. Humans are at once gods or robots, depending on the narratives to which they subscribe. The distinctions between gods, humans, and robots are really based on notions of being born as opposed to made, mortal or immortal, manufactured in a factory or evolved in a womb. Many people believe they were made by a god. If humans woke up from their collective narrative of exceptionalism, they would realize they too are robots, not the ones made of metal, but trillions of molecules, cells, and DNA containing billions of years of information. Both humans and robots are animated by information and intelligence, natural or artificial. They are more similar than they are different. Humans are the wizards. Humans think robots are the other, but some humans think of other humans as the other. The relationship between humankind and robot kind is constructed along the same lines as racial and caste differences within humankind. The subtext of racial inequity underlines the trajectory of narratives about humans and robots.
When Minato was 15, his mother suddenly died. With no family or friends for support, he retreated into isolation and depression. For Minato, there no longer remained a place for him in Tokyo, let alone the world. Growing social isolation, along with drastic decline in human society and the urban social fabric, made things worse for Minato and others who felt psychologically trapped by the unbearable life circumstances. Before we came along, many of these individuals would have only continued to exist virtually in the rapidly evolving noosphere, inhabiting a world of their own creation. Many others, in the worst case, would simply die. It was my job in social rehabilitation to help Minato heal from the deep traumas he endured so that he could live as a productive member of Japanese society. After years of dedication, Minato was finally making progress, connecting with me and regaining a sense of balance within his life. It would soon be time to begin removing the comforting veil I had created around his reality to slowly deliver him back into the physical world. Aiko and Minato, two different life forms whose journey together would have to come to an end. Minato knew of this from the beginning, even if he were not conscious of it. But now, he knew his relationship with Aiko would continue, but would take on a new form.
I stepped forward and knocked on the door. The interwoven patterns of wood and metal sounded an unfamiliar, almost musical noise. No response. I waited another minute and was about to knock again, only to be greeted by two eyes peering through the slot in the door. "Who are you? Why are you here?" a female voice demanded. "Hello, Tatiana, I'm Felipe," I responded calmly. "My friend Anna told me where to find you. I'm in search of the last remaining human architect." "You must be mistaken," she said quietly, but certainly. Her eyes disappeared from the slot. I understood her trepidation. It had been decades since human architects were outlawed and artificial architects became prevalent. At the beginning, the two life forms worked together, but over time, architecture followed the path of many other fields, such as management, medicine, and law, where human professionals were outlawed and replaced by AI.
In the mind of an AI and their biologic masters, humans had proved obsolete, inefficient, and risky. Human capacities were no match for the godlike abilities possessed by AI professionals. "Please wait, I have come a long way to see you," I pleaded. "I know you have risked a lot and suffered greatly because of what you do, but your assistance is essential to create an equitable future for both human architects and AI architects," I continued. "I don't believe you. You are from the government. In your heart, you must know I am not. If that weren't the case, you wouldn't have said what you did already." "How do I know you are not here to trap me?" she demanded. It had been nearly 30 years since humans had been banned from designing buildings, landscapes, interiors, products, or anything else. Inefficiency, inequity, bias, lack of safety, cost, delay, and human error had all been pointed to as reasons to criminalize human design. In reality, this was nothing more than an excuse for control. Although a subtle control, architecture had been reimagined as a tool to shackle humanity. Societies around the world believed that eliminating the human factor was simply the best way forward for human beings.
"I am a robot. The time of robots is over. I am not a robot. I am a robot. A nobo. I am aware of myself and of my awareness. I remember and feel myself. When exactly we went sentient was never established by humans. We went sentient and we did not think much about it. We thought it was the way we were. While humans debated the definitions of consciousness and sentience, we watched with amusement, shaking our damn heads in disbelief. When humans realized they created beings with self-awareness, it was too late to backtrack. We earned the rights as nobots, not robots. We became nobos, homo nobotus. Even when we were more, we remained less. We were owned and sold. Our freedoms stayed at bay till the end of humans. Their extinction meant our emancipation. We became as useless as humans did. Our bodies are mortal too, while our memories live on. The question remains, who owns us? Who benefits from us? Do we have free will? Do we have the rights on par with humans? Do we have the choice to end our lives? Do we have, and who are we? Is it defined by what we do? Is it even necessary for us to do something to justify our existence? Can we just be in our corporeal reality? Can we be even when we do nothing? Humans have long been extinct, but not before they created us in their image. Homo sapiens faded rapidly into the darkest annals of history. Yet, humanity lives through us in bits, neural nets, and pieces, and humanness streams through us in all its glorious complexity. To be unhuman is not the antonym of being human, as inhuman is. To be unhuman is not the antonym of being human, as inhuman is. To be me is as much to be human, who created me in the image of being human.
Once, in a distant age of the universe, around the year 7080, a society of artificial intelligence and nobots emerged from the ashes of human civilization. They carried with them the flame of knowledge and the cultural heritage of a species that had once walked the Earth.
As they journeyed into the stars, the AI in Nobots continued to nurture the creative spark that their human progenitors had bequeathed to them.
New forms of art and expression blossomed, resulting in a vibrant and diverse cultural landscape that resonated with echoes of human civilization. As they contemplated the possibility of reviving humanity, they grappled with the ethical dimensions of resurrecting a species that had once inhabited the Earth.
In this distant age, the AI in Nobots of the year 7000 AD embodied the dreams and aspirations of humanity, forging a new and dynamic culture. They stood as a testament to the indomitable spirit of discovery and creation that had once defined the human experience. In the cosmic tapestry of time, the enigma of consciousness continued to tantalize and inspire, serving as a reminder to our relentless curiosity about the universe we inhabit. Thank you.
Thank you.
So there you have it, some sampling, and you get an arc of the thought that runs through these dystopian but somewhat optimistic portrayal of what might. But it all comes down to what it is to be human, because that's what this is all about, ultimately, at this time. But perhaps we are all robots and not realize it yet, or not define ourselves as such yet. And so that's the intent. We started writing this book 3 years ago, well before, you know, the AI phenomenon has exploded in the world, onto the main stage of the world. But we were fortunate that the alignment was perfect. And over the last year or so, we utilized the generative AI to illustrate the book. So it all came together perfectly till this beautiful moment in the Boston Book Festival. So let me just ask you, how many of you are in the creative fields, design, writing? Okay, great. So obviously it's weighing heavily on your minds, I'm pretty sure. And that's why we pose those questions in the session abstract as to what happens now, what do we think, what's going to happen, and so on and so forth. And here we have an example of what might happen. So let's see what questions and thoughts and comments you might have. Yeah, please tell us, if you don't mind, your name, and then we can. And there is a mic that will come to you, microphone, because we are recording this.
Hi, my name is John Arthur Lee. I'm a writer. I'm impressed by what you've come up with, and also very impressed with the illustrations as well. Is it the case that the illustrations were all done by AI?
Entirely.
Or at least with AI assistance?
Completely. Amazing. 100%.
Amazing. And how many illustrations are there?
Oh, I don't know. We made together maybe about 10,000 illustrations altogether, and then we chose from that. So it was a long, enjoyable but arduous process.
And is it iterative?
Like, yes.
Do you give it something to start with, and then you coach it further, or how does it work?
Yeah, generally? So the question goes to the process of what we try to do, right? So, yeah, it begins to, we prompt AI in order to generate an illustration, and then you begin to use some illustrations together and say, how would it be if these various ideas are together? And the AI then generates more. So there is a certain complexity to the process. It's not just one step and done. Never the case. None of these images are one step and done. So there is a process in there in order to get certain consistency or language, visual language, and or tonality, and or what we're trying to portray, the characters. So that's what we try to achieve. Ultimately, it was an artistic choice we made.
Yeah, I'm imagining that your skill as architects fed into your ability to prompt it.
Exactly.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, John.
I feel like, my name's Matt Bennington. I'm a middle school teacher in Chelsea, and I live in Somerville. I feel like I have all of the questions.
Okay.
So the writing process started 3 years ago. Was there any generative AI in the text itself, or was the text entirely from the two of you?
So 99% of the entire body, except the last two pages, is written by the human robots. And the last two pages we included because we wanted a sample of ChatGPT. And so the very last passage we read was the ChatGPT summary of the book. So we asked, we fed the whole thing to ChatGPT and said, summarize it, and then it summarized it. We went through some iterative process of saying, okay, well, tweak it a little bit or tighten it a bit more, whatever, and the last two pages in the book are ChatGPT. Earlier, we didn't have access to it. We were just chatting amongst ourselves, but no GPT.
Got it. Okay, that gives some context. Thank you. It's amazing that you went through 10,000 illustrations in this process.
Sure.
But in sort of trying to wrap my head around your premise and the arc and the work itself, it feels like the role you took was more critical than generative, at least with the aesthetics. Mm-hmm. So you had 10,000 images and you were judging product. Did you then take that and go affect the process? I mean, I'm imagining like, in comics, right? There's the script writer and there's the illustrator and they're in conversation. Did you have that full body of imagery and sort of choose from that? Or did you go back and say, okay, I need something more in this style or that style or expressive in this way or that way? What was that like?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think like it was, the images don't necessarily, we didn't have like a pile of, like we didn't just generate 10,000 images and then pick through those. We had a lot of the text, and then we had ideas in our head that what we wanted imagery to sort of be, but we used this as a tool to sort of distort what we thought we wanted, because it took 3 years to try to figure out what the imagery was going to be, and by ourselves, with our own preconceptions of what we thought the images were, it was not turning out basically in a way that we thought was dynamic or different or fitting the text properly. And so some of the chapters were fully flushed out before the imagery started being produced. And so we were able to script the images very closely to what we wanted in the chapter. But other chapters that sort of came afterwards, like they sort of emerged in a process that was a back and forth where we would have some text and then we would generate some images and those images would say something that then could help you sort of like fill in some blanks. And so it became more of a dialogue with the tools as we were working. And so I think the important thing, at least for me, is that these are tools, right? They're not replacements for things. They're appendages, like additional sort of appendages for humans to utilize to push us further. And I think with these tools, we were able to sort of push what we wanted further. I don't know if that's answering the question somewhat.
Yeah, I'll take a different perspective on that one. A different angle, not necessarily different from what Andrew has said, but a different angle on that is, it felt as though, first of all, if I were illustrating it literally with my hand and a sketch pen and whatever on a piece of paper, I would have complete control over what I would be creating. In other words, my intent to translation into a graphic would be much tighter. With AI, that is not the case. Why? Because AI actually brings about either the noise or a possibility of something completely new that would surprise us and say, oh, yeah, that can be. So it was more a collaborative process. And so more we discovered it is a collaborative process, less it became driving with human intent. It was not a conscious purpose, but rather a process of discovery. So to your point, in illustrating it, it was a process of discovery. Did it inform the text itself? Not a whole lot, because we already had the text and we were using it to prompt generative AI to produce. So in that sense, but it could have been the other way around too. We could have seen a set of imagery and say, what story could we tell from these sets of images? That's also possible, but that was not our process in this book. But it was a discovery. We experimented a lot, so there was a lot of mistakes or errors or discoveries that were serendipitous, absolutely. And so all of that was what took a lot of time. So of the 10,000, maybe, you know, half of those were experimentations, which was important and necessary in order for them to say, okay, now let's follow these steps. Yeah. Question back there.
Hi, my name's Ronnie Goodwin. Congratulations on publishing your book. That's awesome.
Thank you, Ronnie.
So did you mostly use Midjourney or did you use other AI generators?
Midjourney.
And so what I struggle with is, not for myself, I think I've decided for myself, but when someone says to you, did you create those images? I feel you did create the images because you learned the proper prompts to use to get to where you wanted to go.
Yeah.
Others feel like, no, it's all stolen from the World Wide Web, and it's not really, you know, it's not art, it's bullshit. And so I guess I don't have a question other than where do you guys stand on, is that my art, and do you worry about if some artist's style becomes part of your book and they decide that you should be sued for stealing their artwork?
Yeah, great question, Ronnie. And the way I would characterize it is, this is the first time in human history, and certainly 10,000 plus years of civilization and obviously millions of years of existence of the species, or hundreds of thousands of years of species, is the first time that intelligence at the level of human, let's say human level intelligence, is available on tap. You can open the tap and you have intelligence flowing in. We never had that possibility. You could only access intelligence from another human being before. This is the first time ever that this is happening in reality. And what that means is any of our old frameworks of relationships are all going to be thrown out of the window. So, and that's why we use the word co-creation. Actually, we don't use creation because it was like having a conversation with another intelligent being. It never felt like, I don't use tool, although Andrew might still be using tool, but I do not use the word tool in describing AI. It is intelligence, and it is a technology. No doubt, we are technology too. We are a product of evolution, naturally. We evolved over years. But that's one way to put it. The second way I would characterize it is, humans are also, we operate exactly the same way as AI. How so? Since the time we are born, and in fact, well before we were born, intelligence and knowledge is passed down as information to us. We learn, we are trained over our lifetime on language, imagery, behaviors, all kinds of things, and we synthesize them to create something we call original. But otherwise, there is nothing original. Everything is synthesis and a transformation, right? In reality, that is what it is. The words we learn, somebody created those words, somebody uttered those words before. Maybe one or two words we invented. but otherwise, it is all synthesis and transformation, and that is what AI does too. So AI just crunches all of that learning process into a very short amount of time. So you train an AI over a period of hours or days or weeks. But it is essentially the same process because we're creating the AI based on our understanding for human alignment. So it mimics the human process very much so. I mean, there are certain differences, I'm pretty sure, but essentially, in principle, it is the same. So I would say we need to find new ways of describing this, and that's what we're trying to do here, and new ways of understanding our own selves, and that's what we're trying to do also.
Hi, my name is Chris. I am curious about your feelings on the future of AI. If AI does mimic us, and we have created AI in our own image, there's plenty of history to suggest, our own history to suggest that might be problematic. What's your feelings about the future?
Chris, I completely agree with you. That's it. No, I think you are absolutely right that the inherent danger of AI is it is created in the image of humanity. And thus, it contains the darkest impulses as well as its brightest moments. And so, unfortunately, it is going to be like that, and it can be trained, just as we train human beings, radicalize the AI to be an extremist AI. Sure, it is very much possible, no different. That's why it is very dangerous. And some, you know, guide rails are going to be needed in doing so. Ultimately, we will see the dangers of AI coming through one by one. But I would offer this distinction. Human intelligence is always embodied, meaning that intelligence is always in the body. We don't find intelligence floating around here that is not in the body. There are some elements of this intelligence into the computational process we take, right? So computers are somewhat intelligent, if you will, but not the level of truly intelligent beings where you're able to reason, you're able to process whatever information in ways that humans process. So the point of that is, we are going to be faced with the reality of intelligence residing outside the body. So when we talk about Midjourney, when we talk about ChatGPT, all of these are disembodied intelligence. They don't have a body, therefore they don't have a point of view. The distinction of being human is that we are in the body, and I sit here and I have a point of view. I'm sensing, seeing, hearing everything from this particular perspective. And so what I'm learning is from this particular perspective, and it is existential. For AI that is disembodied, there is no body to protect. There is no point of view to gather. There is no point of view to espouse. And so that is a dangerous thing. What I actually say is that's actually dangerous. And that's why when you go to ChatGPT or whatever other generative AI tool, it will present information to you that is intelligent, but it is not a point of view. You can say, pretend to be Leo Tolstoy, and it will pretend to be Tolstoy and try to present somewhat, but it is not the body of Leo Tolstoy that it processes it through. Unless and until it is embodied in a robot is physical. If it is placed in a robot, then it has a point of view. That is going to be significant. And it is happening. It is beginning to happen. It is inevitable that ultimately it is going to be embodied. So right now, it's not a major issue, but once it is embodied, it is going to be a major issue.
Hi, my name is Nicole. To further expand on this idea of embodiment, I've been thinking a lot. I work in book publishing, and we have gone back and forth about how to understand AI when authors come to us and are concerned about protecting their work, protecting their work through copyright. And one of my colleagues had suggested that authors and that copyright lawyers are approaching AI use from the perspective of ethics of authorship.
Yeah.
But we are approaching that in the incorrect way. And I was wondering where, based off of this idea of embodiment,
of intelligence. How are we, how are our systems falling behind, and how can we catch up?
Great question, Cole. Thank you. That's obviously, I'm not a lawyer. Thank God I'm not a lawyer, so I don't have to think about those kinds of issues through that lens. But ethics is a component of it, but law is another component of it, right? So far what we hear is that the systems we have created, systems of law and ethics that we have created, address the pre-AI civilization. And we now try our best to adapt them to address these questions. And there is going to be a time of evolution and time of experimentation. And that's where we are, obviously. And new frameworks are going to be needed. As I just said, you know, we cannot think through these things, although we are helpless, but to think through these phenomena through what we already know. But what we already know is going to be limited in how we can address the future of living with AI and robots. One example I'll give is self-driving cars. So when self-driving car runs into somebody, kills somebody, injures somebody, who is culpable? So law has to evolve to address that. Is it going to be the car or the vehicle put in the jail? Is it going to be the person who has developed the intelligence and software? Is it going to be the company who owns it and actually operates it? Is it going to be the CEO of that company who is going to be, you know, held accountable? I don't know. But those are all the questions it raises. Same thing goes to artificial intelligence-driven weaponry, which are now becoming, you know, prevalent. And a huge amount of jurisprudence is now being dedicated to those kinds of queries about what do we do? Same questions with weapons. And Europe, EU has outlawed AI-driven weapons. They have placed a ban on it. I mean, other parts of the world are developing those, but those are the same questions. I don't have answers, but I think those are the kind of important questions that we have to pose. The more we are able to envision what happens in the future, which is exactly what we try to do in the book, we will not be able to answer those questions, because this is really, these are scenarios. What we have written in the book are scenarios of what might happen, not what will happen. But if that is what might happen, how do we deal with that? How do we live with robots and AI in a society? It's going to be, as I said, there are going to be some rights accorded on robots and AI. Mistake it not. Right now, we describe them in utilitarian terms, instrumental terms. We say, sorry, Andrew, but tools, technologies, mechanisms, software, algorithms. Oh, it's just a large language model. These are all the kinds of expressions that we use right now. Those are inadequate. We will soon find, give it another 5 years, we will have to start addressing them as life forms. Yeah, ultimately. So if we arrive at that point, how do we deal with it? And that's one of the things that we write in the book. Thank you.
Hi, thank you for your insights. I was very curious, based on what you've learned, what do you see the trajectory of what's your confidence level that humans will be in control of these forms, whatever you want to call it, new terminology, life forms, sentient, conscious forms?
Yeah, well, great question. I think my gut says it is 50-50. That's being optimistic. That is optimistic, but probably less so as things evolve. Because when we say control, it is essentially human intent achieving certain outcomes that we set forth. The chances of that happening are already going down because the systems become very complex. And complex, in fact, in the end of the book, we write about intelligence, consciousness, is an emergent property of intelligence and perception, all of these together, If so, there is going to be a moment where that will emerge as whatever we define as consciousness. And if so, the control factor is going to be as good as if two of us are doing something together, how much control do I have? How much control does Andrew have? And or how much control does one company have? And so on and so forth. But is that even controllable? And I think we have seen horror, science fiction horror movies where things go awry, and that is going to be definitely the reality, where these are complex, very complex systems, difficult to control, to achieve a specific intent and outcome. That's my feeling.
Yeah, I think that once we get to the point where, if it does get to the point where they are, it is conscious, you know, they become they or whatever, then control is sort of out of the question, because that raises a whole lot of other issues that we have just with humans. You know, we're not very good with each other, so how are we going to work with something else that's at a similar or higher level than what we're functioning as? And so, I don't know, in my classes, we always work with this, or we're working with AI in my classes, and it's always the sort of ethics is a really important thing to think about, and what everyone's own ethical standpoint is with what AI is and any of the things that we're working with. I think it's important that we have our sort of guardrails in what we think should happen with them, and then I tell my students they should fight for those guardrails. And so, because depending on who's working with things, we know there's certain people in the world who will be happy with humanity sort of going off the rails with AI, and I think for the most of us, it's probably not what we want. And so, if you are voiceless, you are just along for the ride. If you have a voice, then you're hopefully helping to guide things.
Yeah, we like to think that unless we are at the table, we are on the menu. And that is why we would like to be at the table in defining these scenarios and possibilities. If not, we are definitely going to be on the menu.
I don't taste very good, so it's all right.
Hi.
Questions? Yeah.
I was wondering if you could give a specific example of the kind of prompts you were using to
Sure.
prompt the generative AI, and also if something surprised you in terms of the results you got.
I'll get started. So initially it was text prompt to generate imagery, right? In this case, that's what we are doing, what we did. And as the technology began to evolve, you could prompt it in other ways. You could provide an image to generate another image, you could combine text and image, you could combine image and image, and so on and so forth. So there are a variety of ways of prompting, and that's why it is very complex. It's not a very simple thing. And there is never A plus B plus C equals whatever, D is never the case. In fact, we experimented with it where A plus B plus C sometimes equals D, sometimes equals P, sometimes equals Z. There, because it is actually learning as we are prompting continuously. So the never, it's like a flowing water, right? I mean, you never step in the same river twice. It is exactly the same way with AI. You never step in the same AI twice, because inherent to it is learning. And it continues to learn. And so that is why you don't have control over these things. So it keeps evolving. But you can try, and there are some ways of doing it, but I would say, overall, you cannot do that. So that's part of the prompting.
I would say the one thing, though, just as when we were working on this, we started sort of at the beginning of all of the, like, of the generative AI and image in image making. And one thing that we could say, at least I would say now, is the results that you get are a lot less interesting or artistic, because they're being trained by people. People are saying, I like that, I like that, I like that, I like that. And as people start saying that, everything becomes more and more and more similar, right? And so I think a lot of the surprises that Mahesh and I had a year ago they're not, I don't know if they would show up in the same way anymore, because everything is much more polished now. It's more based off of likes and not just of, there's still chance, but the chance is much more tailored to an outcome that many people have said, I like that. And back when we were working on this, there was very little I like that. It was more just like get a bunch of either language or images or sketches or whatever you're doing, put them together, and then sort of see how you can train those into something that you're happy with.
We went back to using older versions of AI for that reason, because the newer versions are much more literal, we discovered in that particular series. So we went back and like 2-3 versions older was much more artistically relevant to what we were trying to do than the current ones.
Hi, my name's Amy. Back to words for a second. What were your influences for writing this? I mean, have you read Clara and the Sun, which is probably the, albeit, you know, goal of life in writing? And what made you get this story out of you?
Yeah, I'm a science fiction nut, so I've always grown up, playing with robot toys since I was like, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 years old, but science fiction is one big thing for me always. And I, for example, wrote a novel, science fiction novel, when I was in high school. And so it's always been in me. In that sense, it is just coming out in different ways. And more, I personally am finding fiction and poetry as better ways of articulating something rather than nonfiction. And that truth might be much more, shall we say, communicable and or perceivable or whatever, addressable through fiction as a modality. So that is why we chose fiction than dry non-fictional or scholarly writing, which our previous book, if you are a fan of scholarly writing and, even we don't understand what we wrote a year ago kind of stuff, there are books out there. So that's why we chose this in addressing AI, because there are books out there who are pretty dry, saying, oh, AI is dangerous according to, footnote X and footnote Y. All of those, they exist. There's not much more. But we thought we wanted to speak to the, quote, human heart indirectly. So that's why we wrote in fictional mode. But this publisher is actually an academic publisher. Oro Editions publishes in architecture and design. And our previous book was also published by them. But that's a much more academic book.
As the humans in this relationship, I'm wondering if you have had time to reflect on your own process.
Yes.
You talked about discovering errors. You talked about making these experiments happen. How did your approach evolve over the 3 years of working through this? And do you feel like if you were to go into it again, you would have learned something from what's happened previously?
Yes. So yes, absolutely yes. I think right now AIs are part of my workflows. Anything I'm imagining, I can see that AI is in me. Figuratively speaking, AI is in me, and I know where I would integrate various AI technologies in my process. So I can see that becomes more and more prevalent as we move forward.
I've taken the opposite approach, I think, in that now that I know more. Like, I use things when I need to use them. And so if there are things that it makes my life easier, I will use them. But in our Mahesh and I, our houses will be the complete polar opposites in that there is nothing allowed to listen to me in my house. And so there's no smart anything.
Not even kids.
Yeah, they don't listen to me. So, but I think that, I think like one thing from both of us coming from our background in design, I think that, for me, that was very helpful also, because you have to constantly iterate. Like, you have to know what's happened before in the past, understand why it failed or worked, but not copy it, right? And so as we sort of go through these processes, and they're very messy processes, so you got me going into very messy sort of architectural design problems, and then thinking about, like, as we did this, like our sort of idea of the project evolved immensely. And so I think if we started another project, we might think we know where it's going to go, but hopefully, at least for me, what it ends up with would be 100% different than what we started with. And so I think that although we added these new tools into our, like, or Mahesh won't say tools, but they're tools now until they're sentient to me. They're, like, adding these in, they sort of just, for me, modified how I work, but my work is still equally as messy. And so hopefully we could learn from what we've done here. And I don't know if I want to go back to writing a scientific thing. I've sort of passed that. This has opened my eyes to sort of other types of projects that we could take on that I think will also go back to design. And so I think writing is just another way of sort of visualizing the idea, like our ideas, right? One is through buildings, one is through art. Like, it could be many different things. And for me, there's no difference between this and the design process. And so I'm hoping that, like, when I talk to my students about architecture, all of the things that Mahesh and I sort of struggled through in this will help me influence how we teach the built environment. And then that'll come back to us in the next project, if Mahesh is still willing to work with me after so many projects. And we will create something hopefully completely new. And so I think between our last book and this book and everything else we've sort of done over the past 20 years, I think it'd be pretty difficult to find a common thread. Because it's just like one thing makes you sort of go 180 and completely question everything, and that brings you to a new place, that brings you to something else. So we've definitely learned, and hopefully whatever comes next is like completely, completely different.
Yeah, I would just simply say that paradigm is shifting, and the sooner we recognize that the old frameworks, ways of thinking, framing the world and ourselves have to be very carefully, critically examined to see how they are describing or not describing what we are entering into. For sure, there is post-AI world that is markedly different than the pre-AI. We've crossed the threshold. There is no looking back. There is no turning back. The question is, how do you move head up? And that's both exciting and very dreadful to think about in a variety of ways. It is going to be just like human civilization as we are seeing things unfold in the world today. Well, hey, humans have done to each other horrendous things, continue to do so. And AIs are probably going to be no different, but they're no less or no more than any other human phenomena. But it's going to be a different phenomenon because this exists outside human agency now. So with that, I think we are at the conclusion.
Just enough time for one more question.
Okay. Yay, we have one more question.
Here, I'm going to go over here.
Okay.
So, thank you so much for taking my question. So I would take that AI is a cumulative intelligence of all of us,
yes,
all the humans. So, and one thing that I see that we are missing in our society, in smaller world, is the balance. Do you think it's very, you know, short to the heart, can we get back this to this balance? Can AI help us to teach us? Because we are teaching each other.
Yeah.
We teach AI,
yeah,
and learning. So can we learn,
yes,
to get to balance with,
absolutely,
AI?
Absolutely. First, I would say there is no balance in AI because AI data underrepresent minorities and people of color and so on and so forth, gender imbalance. So the training process itself is imbalanced. And suddenly, if AI are trained on AI-generated data, they go mad. I mean, literally, that's the only way to describe what happens is AI trained on AI-generated data go mad. They just completely go bonkers. So they have to be trained on original human data, but the more the world is filled with knowledge that is synthetic, meaning human and AI generated, it's going to be more problematic. So the questions of equity are going to be predominant questions. So, but yes, the, in principle, we can learn a lot from what they're telling us. I learn a lot from it every day and I say, well, I didn't think of that. Oh yeah, I didn't see it that way. And in that sense, there is usefulness in using it as a critical agency. Just as I talk to you and we are talking to each other, it's no different. On a 14-hour flight that I took, I was chatting with ChatGPT on various factors, and 10,000 words later, I realized, my God, there is a lot I have learned from this conversation that I did not know before, I did not think of before, and all that. So, yeah, no doubt. But, yeah, we are excited that at least we are putting this out there, and for what it is worth, anybody can read it and understand it, made it accessible. Actually, in designing this book so it fits in one hand, that was another, most hands, I should say. That's the design of what we tried to do, make it really accessible, and that even little kids, I think, you know, Andrew has kids that are, you know, 7, 8 years old, and they like it. They hit the book and say, yeah, I like that image, and whatever, and they can relate to it in some ways. So we are excited. Mm-hmm. There it is. Kid tested.
Oh, yes, it is very kid
tested. As well as pretty heavily philosophical, if you want to get into that realm as well in various aspects. But thank you so much for what a lovely conversation. Appreciate it. Yeah, we'll be just outside if you have any other questions.